Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the North Koreans casting doubt on whether the upcoming summit in Singapore between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump will happen on June the 12th as they cut off talks with South Korea and lambast Trump's national security advisor John Bolton in an official statement saying that it would be a, quote, ridiculous comedy if Trump paid too much attention to Bolton's positions and that, quote, we do not hide our feeling of repugnance towards him. This prompted Trump to distance himself from the hawkish Bolton and try to clarify what Bolton meant by applying the Libyan model to disarming North Korea in a garbled and incoherent statement, which ended in a threat to decimate North Korea if they did not make a deal with him. Jacob Halbrin, a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, joins us to discuss his article at The Spectator, Could John Bolton Cost Trump His Nobel Peace Prize? And the extent to which Kim Jong-un has mastered the art of the deal and has Trump begging to meet in Singapore, making it clear that it was not Trump's toughness and threats of fire and fury which brought Kim to the negotiating table, but rather Trump's weakness and his narcissistic need to make a deal. Then we look into the highly coincidental reversal by Trump of his campaign mantra that the Chinese were stealing American jobs, to his call on Sunday to rescue the Chinese company ZTE from U.S. sanctions because it is, quote, costing too many jobs in China. This at the same time a state-owned Chinese bank loaned $500 million to an Indonesian developer in partnership with Trump to build a Disney-like theme park, hotel, and golf course in a protected rainforest. Joining us is Sarah Shays, a senior associate at the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who was a special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and whose latest book is Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. We will discuss the brazen contempt President Trump has for the Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution, as well as his daughter Ivanka, who is being paid $1.5 million annually from three companies, one of which manages the Indonesian project. Her 2017 financial disclosure was due Tuesday, but has not yet been released by the Office of Government Ethics. But more outrageous is Donald Trump's almost treasonous disregard of the national security concerns raised by the heads of the CIA, NSA, DIA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and the Director of National Intelligence, all of whom consider ZTE, the Chinese company Trump is rescuing, a national security threat and affront for Chinese intelligence. And joining us now, Jacob Halbrin, who is a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at the New Republic. And he has an article at The Spectator, Could John Bolton Cost Trump His Nobel Prize? Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Halbrin.
Thanks, Ian.
And although there's some dispute over whether or not John Bolton is a neocon or is just a fervent enemy of multilateralism and a rabid nationalist, the long and the short of it is something is weird is going on between him and Trump and Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un's basically sort of driving a wedge between Trump and Bolton, referring to the North Korean diplomat Kim Ki-kwang in an official statement, referred to the ultra-hawkish John Bolton as, we do not hide our feelings of repugnance towards him. And they are upset with what Bolton said in terms of the Libyan model of giving up your nuclear weapons, which the North Koreans interpreted as Kim Jong-un ending up like Gaddafi did, being sodomized by a piece of pipe and being beaten, stabbed, and shot to death by a raging mob. So that's what's happening on one side. And then on the other side, you've got Trump distancing himself from Bolton. So the question would arise, has Bolton gone off the reservation?
No, I don't think so, because in the Trump White House, there is no reservation. We have a president who has at best, a hazy grasp of the issues and doesn't really have a clear conception of American national security. So he's up for grabs, and various officials in the White House try to steer him in the direction that they would like to proceed. And I think it was quite clever of Bolton to drop the reference to Libya, and it was no accident. Bolton has torpedoed negotiations previously in the George W. Bush administration with the North Koreans. He regards them with the same degree of repugnance that they view him. So his objective is to prevent a summit from taking place.
Well, the summit may not take place, and if it does, it may well be, and this is a feeling I've had for some time, is that Kim may use this opportunity on the world stage to humiliate Trump. You always have to be ready for surprises with the North Korean regime. They don't behave like normal countries do, but short of that, isn't it obvious, though, Jacob Harbron, that for all of Donald Trump's talk of fire and fury and the idea that he's tough and Obama was a wimp and everybody else before him was an idiot and he's a tough guy and he's forced Kim to the table, and it's not Trump's toughness that's brought Kim to the table, but it's his weakness, the fact that he desperately needs a deal, he needs a win, he needs to look good. So Kim surely knows that.
Well, I think Kim has already won simply because he managed to extract the promise of a summit from Trump with nothing in return. And now he was the first to threaten to walk, thereby showing that he doesn't need the summit. It is Trump who is trying to propitiate Kim and is begging the North Koreans to show up for the meeting. So I think, yes, Trump looks extremely weak. Now, the way that this summit was sold, there was a column in the Wall Street Journal on Tuesday by Walter Russell Mead claiming that Trump is intent on creating what the Trump White House calls a neo-American moment, in contrast to the post-American moment that Barack Obama allegedly presided over. But if you look at the Trump record, he is systematically squandering American power and influence around the globe. He is not enhancing it.
And is he doing that because he's incompetent, or is there some ideology behind it, or is he doing this as a favor to Vladimir Putin?
I think at bottom, Trump is feckless, and he prides himself on being a businessman who can enter negotiation and has miraculous negotiating skills. And he's also desperate for some kind of diplomatic victory to prove that he can accomplish what Barack Obama and his other predecessors could not. So does Trump even know what would constitute denuclearization? Does he have? He's not preparing for this meeting, we've been told. I think he believes that he can simply walk into this meeting and charm or threaten Kim into acceding to his wishes, which is complete fantasy. To me, the North Koreans are playing this beautifully, and Trump is getting whipsawed.
Well, Trump feels the same way about his meetings with Xi Jinping. He thinks he just absolutely charmed Xi, and he's eating out of his hand, and it's obvious that the Chinese are meeting behind the scenes with the North Koreans. And my understanding, through contacts I have with Swedish intelligence, and they, of course, are the representatives of the U.S. in North Korea, that the Russians have played a big hand behind the scenes in giving Kim Jong-un some guarantees. So it seems like both China and Russia want Kim to make a deal, but you just don't know with the North Koreans. And, you know, maybe both China and Russia are telling Kim, which not that he needs to know it, is that you can take this guy to the cleaners.
Exactly. So the blessing in disguise might be if Bolton does indeed succeed in disrupting a summit and preventing it from occurring. Because if Trump walks into the room and meets with Kim, no one has any idea in which direction he could go.
And again, I'm speaking with Jacob Halbron, who's a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at the New Republic. And he has an article at The Spectator, Could John Bolton Cost Trump His Nobel Prize? And of course, we know that Donald Trump has already talked about getting a Nobel Prize. He's tried to do it in such a way as suggest that, oh, other people are saying it. But I don't think there's much doubt that he's already having sort of Hollywood dreams of kneeling before the King of Sweden or whatever goes on there. So,
well, the other thing we haven't talked about, Ian, is why Trump is so desperate for the meeting with Kim. And that is, of course, because of he's needs to distract from the Russia investigation.
Well, it could be even more sinister or cynical than that. He could be waiting to get his Nobel Prize or have a successful meeting, and he'll, no matter how bad the deal is that he makes, he's going to come out of that, and Sarah Sanders and the Republicans and Fox News are going to say, this is the greatest moment in U.S. diplomatic history, and the president deserves the Nobel Prize, etc. So he'll probably go up in the polls, and I think at that point, when he's high in the polls, that's when he'll strike against Mueller and shut down or limit the Mueller probe.
Well, he certainly would like to do that. It'll be interesting to see whether the summit is perceived as a success. There's no question that Trump, a born salesman, would definitely try to present it as some grand victory for world peace. But whether he's able to do that or not remains an open question. I'm skeptical that this summit is going to take place because the North Koreans are not going to accede to the kind of terms that Trump is presenting for meeting. And they've already won, or they've already pocketed a number of games. So they could just push the summit off and try and wait for another moment when Trump is even more vulnerable.
Well, they have attacked the South and gone back to their old routine of casting aspersions on the South and their crazy kind of belligerent rhetoric, and they're calling the South Korean authorities incompetent and senseless. So, and of course, referring to the fact that some North Korean dissidents spoke before the South Korean parliament, they refer to them as human scum. So that's already back on now. So why do you think the North Koreans are saying they're not going to talk to resume talks with the South unless...
I think they're recoiling at the kind of demands that Bolton and even Trump today was making, that they hand over their nuclear materials. It's possible that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, if his more step-by-step plan is embraced by Trump, that then maybe they could work out a deal with the Koreans. But I do think that it's going to be very touch and go up until June 12th, whether this summit actually takes place.
Well, Pompeo's been the one that's been negotiating with the North Koreans, so presumably he knows what's going on. I don't know whether, as you say, when I asked you, is Bolton off the reservation? You said there's no reservation at the White House because it is so chaotic. So I don't know whether Bolton and Pompeo have come to an understanding about who's doing what. But is there a basic misunderstanding here about what was said about the Libyan model? In other words, Libya gave up their nuclear weapons and then, you know, a few years later, they were invaded by the U.S. and a European coalition. And as we mentioned earlier, Gaddafi came to an ignominious end. that is clearly something that's got the North Koreans crazy. Now, they say they're upset also with the military exercises that are going on with an extra few squadrons of F-22 fighters have apparently showed up there. They're doing Air Force exercises. They say that's what's got them really upset with the South. But is there a misunderstanding here? Did Bolton mean the nuclear negotiation model? Because it looks as if Trump doesn't understand the difference between killing Gaddafi on the one hand or him giving up his weapons on the other. And then Trump went on to say the Libyan model was such a different model. This is when he's distancing himself from Bolton to try and assuage Kim Jong-un. He's saying the Libyan model was such a different model. We decimated that country. We never said to Gaddafi, oh, we're going to give you protection. We went in and decimated him, and we did the same thing with Iraq. So I guess that's a peculiar reassurance to Kim. We're not going to decimate you. But it does seem that I'm not sure that Trump knows what Bolton said and what's upset Kim. Do you?
No, I don't think Trump has the slightest clue. I mean, his statement today was completely incoherent. And he also did end up threatening the North Koreans if they don't abide by his terms. So I think Bolton was very, from his own perspective, it was very astute of him simply to mention the word Libya, because that's such a red flag, as you know, for Vladimir Putin as well. Yeah. Putin is said to have obsessively viewed the tape of Gaddafi being murdered and suspects the United States of trying to engineer a color revolution inside Russia as well. And this is the great fear of all of these dictators. And Kim Jong-un is a young man. I don't think he has any intention of going out of business out of the family business in North Korea. So it was somewhat diabolically clever of Bolton just to drop that word Libya, because it's one that's pregnant with meaning for these foreign dictators. And they absolutely, in Iran as well now, when I saw the Iranian foreign minister a few weeks ago in New York, I asked him, isn't the lesson of the fact that Trump is willing to negotiate with North Korea, isn't a lesson that you need a bomb if you're going to face the United States? And the foreign minister Zarif said, no, no, no. But clearly that lesson has been drawn. It's inconceivable to me that Kim Jong-un is going to denuclearize. There's no way he would leave his regime open to the kind of scenario that happened in Libya.
Well, nobody would be paying him any attention but for his nuclear weapons.
Exactly. And this has been going on. This has been a central goal of the regime for decades. They've invested a huge amount of money and effort in trying to develop nuclear weapons. So I continue to think that the Trump administration is peddling a fantasy. Now, they may sign some kind of, I guess the positive case would be they sign some kind of limited deal that de-escalates tensions, and the North begins to make a few concessions, and we provide economic aid in exchange. I mean, I think that's what Pompeo is envisioning, some kind of gradual de-escalation of tensions. But the notion that we're going to have peace in our time, to use the Neville Chamberlain phrase, is as much a fantasy today as it was back then.
So what do you think's going on then? Let's just go to the other players in the background here, the Russians and the Chinese. They have apparently also made some kind of agreements with the North, some kind of promises to get him to the table with the Americans. They seem to want that. It was, after all, Chinese sanctions that really hurt Kim. Nothing else, not the American sanctions the UN sanctions. The Chinese sanctions were part of the UN, but the Chinese went along with them. And I think that really got Kim's attention, didn't it?
Absolutely. And the objective of the Chinese would be to see American troops begin to withdraw from South Korea, which is something that Trump might be prepared to do. The Chinese see Kim as obviously as a client, and they want to, as far as possible, extrude the United States from East Asia. So this would be a golden opportunity to begin the process, or to further the process, of diminishing American influence in the region.
Well, obviously, they're mad at Kim Jong-un for bringing the Americans in, or bringing more American military power into the region. They were upset about the deployment of the THAAD anti-missile system. So everything that Kim is doing with his nuclear testing and ballistic missile testing is drawing the Americans into the region as opposed to getting them out. So I can understand China's position. I'm not entirely sure about what Russia is up to, if indeed it's true that they've been playing a hand behind the scenes in urging the North Koreans to make this deal and perhaps offering some sweeteners.
Yeah, but ultimately it's China that has the dominant influence in North Korea. And from Kim's perspective, interestingly, if he really is serious about trying to reach out to the United States, he could try and lessen his dependence on Beijing by establishing a better relationship with the United States.
Well, what do you think is, I mean, as I said, I've been suspicious all along that this could be, at the end of the day, a kind of plan on Kim's part to humiliate Trump after all the terrible things that Trump said about him. And he, by the way, they don't have a sense of humor, these North Koreans. They take this stuff very seriously. And they also have delusions about this regime tells its own people that we are the center of the world and the rest of the world is a mess and we're these chosen people and all that insanity. So it's not inconceivable to me that Kim's going to find a way to appear on the world stage and humiliate Trump. But on the other hand, it seems like he's already in the catbird seat here. He's already got Trump, the representative of the most powerful nation on the earth, begging to meet with him, and he'll sign anything as long as they can come out looking good.
Exactly. It's very unfortunate, which it gets back to my suspicion that maybe Bolton's obstreperousness could be a blessing in disguise, simply because Trump is so unpredictable, volatile, and tempestuous that no one really knows what he would be prepared to do to propitiate the North Korean regime. It could be a complete fiasco for American interests in East Asia.
Well, but throughout the world, it's a fiasco for American interests. I must say that watching what happened at the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem and then simultaneously the Palestinians being shot down by Israeli snipers, the rest of the world saw that. And it was so embarrassing to see Ivanka beaming and Mnuchin, you know, the vulture capitalist who exploited all of those people. He made homeless millions of people and made millions out of making millions of his fellow Americans homeless. These seem like the biggest bunch of bottom feeders, just shocking. And then to have these crazy evangelical lunatics with their sick interpretation of the book of Revelation, and the only reason they love Israel is because they want Israel to start Armageddon and end up in the lake of fire like all of us, and while they get raptured up to heaven. This is insanity. And then on top of that, Ivanka and Jared are blessed by the Israeli rabbi who referred to African immigrants in Israel as monkeys.
That isn't even the end of it. I mean, there's the withdrawal from the Iran deal, and then there's the news today that Qatar is prepared to bail out Jared Kushner on his 666 Fifth Avenue building.
Right, as a way.
Underwater.
Right, but that's how they originally, Jared and his father went to the Qataris and said, give us a half a billion for this building. You know, otherwise we're going to sick the Saudis onto you and blockade you. The Qataris told them to go to hell. The Saudis blockaded them. So now it looks like they're going to get the half a billion to end the blockade. Have you ever seen foreign policy conducted by a family of crooks?
No. At bottom, though, the Trump administration is about personal enrichment. You also saw Trump properties in Indonesia are getting a $500 million loan.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that in the next segment, as a matter of fact.
So, yeah, I didn't mean to anticipate you, but so this is at bottom. When we talk about Trump and national security, we should be careful not to make it more coherent than it is. At bottom, it is about venality and profiling himself. So whatever he can try and pitch as a public relations success in North Korea is what he's going to embrace. It's not going to be about U.S. national security. It's
right.
About what benefits Donald Trump.
Right, and it's also embarrassing amateurism and putting America in a terrible light and doing irreparable damage to our reputation and standing in the world. I thank you for joining us, Jacob Holbrun.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Holbrun, who's a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at the New Republic. And he has an article at The Spectator, Could John Bolton Cost Trump His Nobel Peace Prize? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sarah Shays, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, formerly a special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. She's an expert on kleptocracy and anti-corruption, South Asia policy, and civil-military relations. A former reporter, she covered the fall of the Taliban for National Public Radio, then left journalism to remain in Kandahar in order to contribute to the reconstruction of Afghanistan. Her latest book is Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Shays.
Thanks for having me.
And it's somewhat went under the radar. We all recall when Donald Trump first announced his presidency on the escalator there at Trump Tower, where he talked about Mexicans being thieves and rapists, and that, of course, got a lot of attention. But the next press conference that he had a few days later, he introduced the press in Trump Tower to an Indonesian businessman with whom he said, we'll do great deals. This businessman, of course, turns out to be the bagman for General Prabowo, who had lost the election. He's a part of the Suharto clan, who embezzled something between $30 and $40 billion from the Indonesian people. So that was right out of the gate. So what's your understanding or reading on Donald Trump's sense of foreign policy to the extent to which it seems to be intermingled with private business?
Let me answer that by turning the issue around just a bit, to say that what I have been seeing internationally, you know, developing particularly in about the last 10 to 15 years, is the crystallization of what you could think of as transnational networks that weave together key government officials, businessman. You talked about this guy as a bagman, but I actually think he's more than a bagman. I actually think he is a key private sector member of that Indonesian network. And these networks actually include out-and-out criminals that supply, for example, deniable physical force. They supply, you know, the ability to cross borders illicitly, you know, because that's their specialty. They supply all kinds of capabilities to the network that the ostensibly licit sides of the network don't specialize in. The government officials, what their job is to basically bend government agencies and institutions to serve not the public interest, but the interests of the network. Now, these networks are transnational. So the Indonesian network is, the node for it is in Jakarta. But right there at that press conference, you see how it's sending a tentacle directly into the sort of embryonic American version of a kleptocratic network. And that network has now, that embryonic version has essentially now been born. And we're seeing it in the ongoing overlapping of public position and private business activity in this administration to an unprecedented degree. Not that it's never existed before, but it certainly is kind of out in the open in a way that it hadn't been in the United States before.
And how does these nodes in Jakarta and now Washington relate to other nodes in Beijing, Moscow, Ankara, Manila, etc.?
Well, exactly. So in this particular case of the relationship with Indonesia, you have the Chinese, a couple of Chinese state enterprises that are investing in one of the complexes that this business partnership has developed. Now, interestingly, that complex, which is called the Lido, maybe about 60 miles outside of Jakarta, if I remember correctly, it's in protected tropical forests. So not only has this complex received the financial assistance of the Chinese government via state-owned enterprises, it's also received the intangible but extremely valuable assistance of Indonesian government officials who have effectively waived environmental regulations and permitting requirements, among other things. And so it really demonstrates precisely this intermingling of private benefit, public monies, the diversion of public monies to private gain, and then the exercise of public functions on behalf of the network rather than, or the networks, rather than on behalf of the public interest. So you're having a tropical forest that's being deforested, villagers that are being expelled, and so on in this particular case. So these are not victimless crimes. The money involved is kind of eye-popping. And yet we often, when we talk about statistics, we forget that there is real value, there's intrinsic value in terms of people's lives, in terms of the environment, in terms of people's livelihoods, in terms of kind of future health and sustainability of communities and their landscapes that are put to the sword, if you will, including years off of people's lives when pollution is the result of some of these deals. So the victims are very significant, and the victims will, when they feel like the entire system is completely rigged by this type of network capture, they often turn to extremes. But just back to the specifics of your question, you named exactly the right countries. And what's so interesting is if you look at the pattern of where people involved in these networks do business, they do their business in other countries that are controlled by similar networks. And so I was struck to see how often the Trump Organization was choosing to do business in places that are controlled by kleptocratic networks. And the Philippines is an obvious one, and China is another obvious one. Panama is an interesting, obvious one. And so there's not just the Trump Tower, Panama City, but there was also, you know, the Miss Universe going to Panama. And then you had Miss Universe going to Moscow, a huge effort to build a Trump Tower or a Trump complex in Moscow that eventually was abandoned. But the idea that he had no interest in placing that those golden letters on a building in Moscow is incorrect. The other interesting point there is the gentleman with whom he worked in particular on Moscow, both on the Miss Universe, on the effort to get a Trump branded physical building complex there, and on the famous meeting that took place in Trump Tower, New York on June 16th, or I guess it was Trump Tower, Washington, on June 16th during, no, it was New York, excuse me, during the campaign, the meeting with the lawyer who had close Kremlin contacts that a number of the U.S. attendees lied about, et cetera. The guy who set that up, Agalarov, is known as a Russian rock star, and he's known, he and his father are known to be close to Putin. Interestingly, they're actually from Azerbaijan, and the rock star is actually the former son-in-law of Ilham Aliyev, the president of Azerbaijan. Now, that is one of the most consolidated kleptocratic networks I've ever studied. It's an almost complete overlap between the public and private sector members of that network. So, for example, shortly after Ivanka Trump was appointed to her position at the White House, Aliyev appointed his wife as his vice president, and the family owns 11 banks. That's basically the entire financial services sector in Azerbaijan. And so there you have, you know, the transnational intersection of the Russian, Azerbaijan, and nascent or embryonic American kleptocratic networks.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Shays, who's a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was formerly a special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and is an expert on kleptocracy and anti-corruption, South Asia policy, and civil-military relations. A former reporter, she covered the fall of the Taliban for National Public Radio, then left journalism to remain in Kandahar in order to contribute to the reconstruction of Afghanistan. And her latest book is Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. So back to the ZTE deal, where on Sunday, Donald Trump appeared to reverse himself in terms of all his campaign promises and said that he was working with President Xi Jinping of China to give ZTE a way back into business fast because it was costing too many jobs in China. And then, of course, on Wednesday, the head of the FBI warned about ZTE. And then prior to that, back in February, on a Capitol Hill hearing, both the head of the FBI, the Director of National Intelligence, the head of the DIA, the head of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the head of the CIA, then Mike Pompeo, and Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA, all said that ZTE was a threat to America and that we shouldn't be using their products. And the fear is that these cheap smartphones that ZTE makes have a backdoor to Chinese intelligence. So in the coincidence, of course, is that when coinciding with Trump deciding to rescue ZTE from sanctions, a Chinese company, a state-owned company, provided $500 million in financing, some of which goes into this Trump resort in Indonesia, this Disneyland-like theme park and six-star hotel and golf course. So if these connections are proven, as they appear to be, pretty flagrant, this is more surely about violation of U.S. national security. And we know that the president's kind of at war with the national security establishment and the so-called deep state that he keeps blaming for his problems. But this is this goes beyond attacking the FBI and the DOJ. This is really, he's being warned by all of our national security agencies not to do this. And so I'm surprised that there's not more of a pushback. What would explain that to you?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question about why there isn't more pushback. I think we've gotten ourselves, and so now I'm sort of speculating outside of my own area of expertise into American politics, which
you were an assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and you have dealt with civil military relations, and I think nothing is more stark in that regard than what just happened yesterday at the VMI.
But you asked me why is there not more pushback, and that requires an assessment of the American people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more comfortable in saying, look, this is clearly into the national security realm. It's clearly smack in the middle of where the president of the United States ought to be. The first priority ought to be the national security of the United States of America, and the statement of that is very clear. On the kleptocracy side or on the corruption side, the point is that we have a constitutional provision that is across the board, extremely broad, extremely sweeping, which is federal officials shall not accept any item of value from any foreign government or its agent. You don't have to ask whether that item of value was given with corrupt intent. It doesn't matter whether there was a quid pro quo, whether the ZTE decision is a quid pro quo for the Indonesia, you know, $500 million, or for the patent, you know, the patents in China or whatever. The point is you cannot accept anything of value, and this president has done so. And part of the point of that sweeping prohibition is, first of all, so you don't have to get into the details and the lawyerly hair splitting about, you know, what constitutes corruption and was this a bribe and did he perform an official act in return for the bribe and blah, 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 which our Supreme Court has gone down very deep rabbit holes on. The point is we are going to cut off even the opportunity for corruption by saying you don't take gifts. Secondly, the second really important aspect of that very wise prohibition is that the American people shouldn't have to scratch their heads about whether their public officials are acting in the national interest or acting in their own private interest. That should not even be an issue that arises. And in the complex of questions that you've just raised, Americans have absolutely every right to be scratching their heads, in fact, to be quite anxious about it. Why they're not, why the general public is not, is a hard one for me to answer. But the fact that we're deep into terrain that we shouldn't be in, whether the United States' physical security is being undermined for the purposes of advancing public officials' private gain, it's scary.
Right, and the public official we're talking about is the President of the United States, and he appears to be prioritizing doing some kind of business favor to either Xi Jinping, the Chinese, and of course the collateral is that he and his family are being enriched by this deal at the expense of American national security and overriding the warnings of all of the heads of the American national security.
American citizens certainly have every right to assume to read these events that way.
Right.
I'm not willing to say there definitely was, that I can assure you there was a quid pro quo. It certainly looks enough that way as to undermine the faith and trust of the American citizens in their own institutions. And that is fatal to a democracy.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we are continuing the conversation with Sarah Shays, who's a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was formerly a special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and a former reporter covering the Taliban for National Public Radio in Afghanistan. She left journalism to remain in Kandahar in order to contribute to the reconstruction of Afghanistan. And her latest book is Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. But in terms of the emoluments or violations thereof, Trump himself has received management fees from the Indonesian project. But more, I think, to the point, Trump's daughter Ivanka, who's a senior White House advisor, has received a total of $1.5 million annually from three companies affiliated with the Trump Organization that include one that manages the Indonesian project. And her financial disclosure forms were due on Tuesday. They have not been released. But $1.5 million is a good chunk of change, is it not?
It sure is. And not only that, she produces a variety of merchandise in China. She received, I think the Trump Organization received patents. I think she's also received patents in China. Now, patents, again, it's not actual cash. It's extremely valuable because you can't do the same kind of business in China if you don't have the patent protection that you can when you do. And you're also subject to very costly legal proceedings if you don't have patent protection. Those patents were pending for years until President Trump was inaugurated. And the problem is, as I say, I think the issues that you're raising are extremely egregious right now. But I really think it's important for this whole question not to be exclusively scotch taped to the Trump name. This is a direction in which the United States has been drifting for at least a couple of decades, but most particularly for the past, 5 to 7 years. And when I examine kleptocratic networks, there's another feature that comes up every single time, and it is some kind of a private foundation or a charity that the president's family or the chief of state's family is running that serves as a black box that either people are required to contribute to, either, public employees are required to contribute to it, or people wishing to do joint ventures are required to contribute to it. And so I don't want to tread into the territory of false equivalencies here. But I think it's very important for people who are concerned about this issue to be rigorous with their own sides, their own political people with whom they share a political leaning, with their weaknesses as well. And when the King of Morocco put money into the Clinton Foundation, in the United States, I don't think she was still Secretary of State at the time, but she was clearly going to run for president. I mean, so it's not technically a bribe under U.S. law, but that is not something that ought to be defended. The idea that Secretary Clinton did not fully sever her connection to the Clinton Foundation, potentially agree to change its name, when she chose to assume the mantle of Secretary of State of the United States is very troubling also. And so this is a slide in the way that American elites understand what constitutes corruption that is not shared by the general population. And so what Thieves of State does is look in particular at what is the reaction that you see among the disempowered population that's up against a system that is rigged in these types of ways. And at the time, I was looking particularly at the extremist religious reaction. And what I found is it turns out to be a relatively frequent reaction in Christian environments as well as Muslim environments for people to react by espousing violent puritanical religion. So a lot of the recruitment into terrorist organizations of late has been among people who are completely beside themselves and indignant at this type of rigged system. I'm not saying their response is a good one. I'm just saying I have documented it. Another way people have responded has been to, you know, rise up in revolution across the Arab world in 2011, the Ukraine, Burkina Faso in 2014, or less dramatic public mass protests that have toppled a lot of governments of late, like that the government of Guatemala, the government of Brazil, the government of South Korea, the government of Armenia recently, the government of South Africa in an even more policed sort of way, I want to say political process kind of way. But this has been a really significant cause of the downfall of governments. And another way people have responded has been to vote for basically wrecking balls. And so I actually find that the United States has fallen into this precise pattern in electing Donald Trump, or the way the votes are counted, elected Donald Trump. But one way or another, he got a lot more votes than the elites expected him to get, the elites on either side, possibly than he expected to get. And so what I'm saying is there's a huge divergence between indignation on the grassroots level at rigged systems, at systems that are captured by kleptocratic networks like this, and a very mincing definition of corruption on the part of elites, be they Democrats or be they Republicans.
Now, my understanding, though, just in closing, Sarah Shays, is that none of what we're talking about here and what you've written about in your book, Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security, none of it would be possible but for offshore banking and bank secrecy. And you have the commingling of criminal money and plutocratic money. And is that why nothing can be done about it? Because you'd think there'd be enough of a lobby out there to want to get rid of criminal money. But my understanding is it's being thwarted by the fact that too many wealthy people and multinational corporations also hide their money offshore.
I think that's correct. There is a rising effort that's gaining a lot of traction to not only make it harder to shroud money offshore, but in general, making it harder to shroud the actual owners, the identities of the real beneficiaries of corporations that are formed often for the purposes of hiding money. But I actually think the reason these kleptocratic systems are so hard to fight is, number one, because of their network nature. Number two, and networks are really resilient. What they are willing to sacrifice often their leadership in the interests of their overall survival. And so what I would say is people who really want to work and fight on behalf of government by and for the people need to think beyond the figurehead who represents the network to the network in general. They need to be quite tough on the enablers of these networks. And chief among the enablers of the networks are, as you suggest, the offshore secrecy jurisdictions, banks and real estate companies that are turning a blind eye to very dodgy money that they are helping people invest, but also things like think tanks and universities that are delighted to, you know, offer platforms to people who frankly have looted the commons of their own countries or even the United States, or, you know, law firms here that choose to represent kleptocrats. No one is forcing them to represent kleptocrats. Now, I'm not saying that every suspected criminal doesn't deserve representation. That's fine. But I, as a lawyer, have a choice, an ethical choice about who I will spend my time and effort defending. And every clearly kleptocratic client that I take is an opportunity cost where I could be taking the case of a genuinely honest reformer who's also facing legal difficulties. And so I think the public needs to raise the bar, raise the standards. And that also means raise the standards in their candidate for office. So I think it would be really important for Americans to start thinking about what are some basic principles of a pledge that they would like to see candidates sign up to, be they Republican or Democratic, that include small donor campaigns, for starters, a promise to work for legislation for either vouchers that make it possible for ordinary citizens to compete with moneyed interests in spending money as speech, which is what it now amounts to in the United States, or for public financing of campaigns, and for making the bribery legislation much more stringent than it currently is at both the state and federal levels.
Well, Sarah Chase, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Chase, who's a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was formerly a special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and is an expert on kleptocracy and anti-corruption, South Asia policy and civil-military relations. A former reporter, she covered the fall of the Taliban for National Public Radio, then left journalism to remain in Kandahar in order to contribute to the reconstruction of Afghanistan. And her latest book is Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, one more light goes on.